You're listening to Nick Luck Daily, bringing you the latest news and the best interviews from around the world of horse racing. This episode is brought to you by the Racehorse Owners Association, by Thoroughbred Racing Commentary's Global Rankings in partnership with the Saudi Cup, and by the Fitzdares Club. Good morning, welcome to the show. It's Tuesday, June the 22nd. It's a bit cool, grey, overcast here in TW11, but I'm reliably informed it's much sunnier and brighter the further north in the country you go. I'm sure that's always the case. And lots to talk about over the next half an hour or so, particularly the news that there might be the possibility of a fifth day extension to the Cheltenham Festival, which Tom and guests did very well yesterday, but has clearly not stopped being talked about all across social media. So we'll pick up the thread in a few moments' time. Still picking out the best of Royal Ascot and where the heroes from that meeting will head next. Talk a little about the Irish Derby at the weekend and the reappearance of High Definition, this time against the Derby runner-up and third, Adair and Hurricane Lane. But important news emerged last night pertaining to a big story that we featured on this podcast last week, and that was Jim Bolger's allegations of doping at a high level in Ireland. And the Irish Parliament, the legislature, has got involved. Jane Mangan, the RTE broadcaster and Racing TV contributor, is with me this morning. Jane is coming to you from Tattersalls, where she's attending the Derby sale there. Jane, now what's going on here?
Yes, so obviously the discussion has caught the attention of TDs and government. So the Oireachtas Agricultural Committee assembled yesterday and they discussed Jim Bolger's allegations in Leinster House. Several members spoke in favour of holding a hearing into the issue before the summer break. So basically they want to inquire further into the various departments. So they've agreed to invite senior officials from the IHRB, from HRI and from the Department of Agriculture, basically to question the allegations of doping in Irish horse racing. They've also invited Jim Bolger, the committee chair. Jackie Call has suggested that this hearing is likely to be in early July. So basically, essentially, the IHRB, the Department of Agriculture and HRI will all face questions from the Oireachtas Committee. It'll be held virtually and each side will have the opportunity to give an opening statement before TDs and senators will then have the opportunity to ask their own questions within a specific time slot.
So this is a government select committee hearing, the Oireachtas, the Irish legislature, and you're getting upper house and lower house officials all able to question people from Department of Agriculture, Horse Racing Ireland, Irish Horse Racing Board and Jim Bolger. Now, the nuances are important here because Horse Racing Ireland is a state body, effectively. Is that right?
Correct. And we are an industry that is funded or subsidised by the government. And you can understand with such serious allegations in an industry which is so prominent in this country that they would naturally take an interest and want to ask questions that the public deserve answers to as well, because of course it is taxpayers' money at the end of the day. It is notable when Jim Bolger speaks, if he does take up the invite, he doesn't have to take the invite, that his hearing will likely be separate and he won't be protected by Oireachtas legal privilege, meaning essentially if he isn't likely to say anything more than we've heard already, because again, if he names names, he isn't covered by Oireachtas legal privilege. So that is something to note.
And just going back to your point that HRI is a state body, will representatives from Horse Racing Ireland and the IHRB feel themselves at a greater level of scrutiny, greater accountability? Will it be a slightly different experience for them?
Yes, and I suppose we are in the industry and we have been asking maybe intricate questions. When you're dealing with maybe TDs and senators that are looking from the outside in, they will ask more broad and curveball questions. And basically, an Oireachtas committee is perfectly entitled to summon anybody to a hearing. Ordinarily, it would just be the regulator, the IHRB. So the fact that members of the Oireachtas have opted to invite the HRI and the department as well is broadening the spectrum as such, because I thought the regulator would probably be the main one under pressure here, but it feels like all aspects of HRI and everybody is going to be summoned, and it's a little bit of a head scratcher. The Oireachtas committee is a public committee. This hearing will be streamed for the public to watch, and it'll be very interesting to see the outcome.
Obviously, we've been preoccupied with Royal Ascot the last few days since Jim Bolger's interview with Paul Kimmage and then his appearance on this podcast, then Poetic Flair's victory in the St James's Palace Stakes. How do you think the racing community in Ireland is reacting and responding to this as we speak?
It's not positive. Like, there's no positive outcome to this. We are essentially speculating. Without any evidence, this is all speculation. And I feel amongst the public and amongst people in the industry, it's very much a watch and wait scenario. I know myself, having listened and read as much as I can on the topic, when somebody like Jim Bolger speaks, yes, you listen. But when he says a Lance Armstrong magnitude scenario in this sport, you know he's, you know, suggesting a top tier establishment. And a top tier establishment in Ireland regularly competes abroad successfully. So if you're questioning the testing and you're questioning maybe the effectiveness of the regulator, then surely you can take solace in the fact that there has been no Irish horse test positive abroad. But again, we're waiting for actual factual evidence. Until then, all of this is just speculation.
And just before we started recording this morning, I did send a message to Jim Bolger asking him whether he would be taking up the Oireachtas invitation to appear before that committee, and he said probably. So that's the latest from the master of Cuchulainn. Right, Jane, on to a subject that is less grave, but one that exercises everyone to an extraordinary extent. Fifth day to the Cheltenham Festival. Are you in favour or not in favour?
You know what, when you talk about one subject to this subject, it feels like it's much lighter, shall we say. A 5-day Cheltenham, it's inevitable. It doesn't mean I'm in favour of it. I don't think it is good for racing, but I think money talks. Already there's too many races at Cheltenham. There's 28 races over 4 days, and realistically, how many championship races? There's 14 grade ones, 5 of them in open class, and we're giving horses the opportunity to avoid each other all day long. That's fine. Look, they're going to add a fifth day. If you're adding a fifth day, the Gold Cup has to be the final day. I've read some reports where the Gold Cup could be still on the Friday. Well, that, if you have the Gold Cup on a Friday, then you've left the air out of the balloon. Saturday will just drag. You're likely to have smaller fields. Yes, you're having more opportunities for people to have winners at Cheltenham, but the whole point of having such a high level of competition is that it is difficult to have winners at Cheltenham. Look, I'm not in favour of it, but it's inevitable. It seems like the decision's already made.
But if they only add 2 more races, which is all they need to make it 6 races a day, and if you bring back the race you've just got rid of, which actually I thought was quite a good race, that novice handicap chase, it threw up a ton of nice horses like Aplutar and whatnot. If you bring that back, then you only add 1 more race. You add 1 more race. Hasn't the genie already been let out of the bottle as regards quality dilution? Can you really dilute it any further now if you're only adding 1 more race?
Yeah, that's a fair point. And I think when you see the brilliance of the Dublin Racing Festival, the 2-day festival at Leopardstown, that's concentration of quality at its best in the discipline of National Hunt Racing. Cheltenham doesn't have that. Cheltenham has 2 top races maybe a day, and that's the way it works. And obviously it's a festival, and it's about the people, and it's about commercial, and it's about money essentially, and that's what it generates. And yeah, if it's going to happen, that's fine. It doesn't mean that you'd have to be, you don't have to be in favor of it to accept that it's likely to happen. And I think what the 4-day festival came in 2005, it's not taken 20 years, but it's been talking about for a very long time. And I think it's inevitable.
Well, the interesting thing is that the addition of races has taken place, you know, incrementally over time. It's the creep, isn't it? So when the 4-day festival first came in, you didn't really sense that there was that significant a dilution of quality, because obviously the management was quite conscious of that. There's possibly a danger of that happening again. So you go to 5 days, you have 6 races a day. Fine, you've only added 1 more race, no big deal. In 10 years down the track, will you be sticking a 7th race on every day? You know, a la what Royal Ascot have just done. Night follows day, that would be the logical endpoint. And then people get even more uncomfortable.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. Royal Ascot have done it. Royal Ascot did it last year, thought it was going to be once off. It happened this year. Royal Ascot finishes at 4:30, really. because the handicaps after half four could be run in the middle of the week. They're run for punters, they're run for betting pools, and that's fine. I appreciate that's important, but it's not what Royal Ascot is about. And I think it has definitely dampened the festival somewhat. And I noticed that myself last week, that I left the house after 5 o'clock, didn't even watch the last race. And the in terms of Cheltenham, yes, the handicaps like the Boodles, Fred Winter, and the novice handicap, like, they're not championship races. And we want, and Cheltenham is often referred to as the Olympics of the sport. It might be the Olympics of the sport in terms of spectators, but the quality is literally one or two races a day. And after that, it's just run at the same track.
So, in short, you're not in favour of a fifth day to Cheltenham.
No, but I accept it's going to happen, and I can see why there are pros and cons for both, and realistically, money will win.
What about if they do want to run on a Saturday, making it Wednesday to Saturday? So the argument being that you open up the weekend to people who are working all week. What about if they want to come racing at the weekend, people who want to watch racing on the telly at the weekend? Where does that sit with you?
Yeah, I think we're splitting hairs. I think if you want to go to Cheltenham, you'll make it happen, and I think Cheltenham sells out almost every day anyway, so splitting hairs.
Well, Jane Mangan's still with me. Jane, I want to get your reflections on Ascot, because we missed you during Ascot week. You did threaten to make an appearance. Did it ever happen?
It didn't happen because the Irish government decided on Tuesday night to change their quarantine rules, which basically, if I wanted to attend the sale at Tattersall's this week and the Curra this weekend, I couldn't do both, so I had to prioritise, and it was unfortunate, but hopefully we'll make up for lost time next year. But I did enjoy watching from home. Started off in brilliant fashion with Palace Pier. I have spoken at length about Palace Pier on this podcast in the past, how he's awesome and brilliant, but what has he really beaten? And then an hour or two later, Poetic Flair did what he did in the St. James's Palace. And having looked forward to Royal Ascot for so long, after day one, I was always already thinking about another race meeting where those two-milers could eventually meet, and we could see if Palace Pier can give weight to a three-year-old of the calibre of Poetic Flair, who, let's be honest, is leading the three-year-old category by a storm.
When you said those two-milers, I wondered for a moment whether you were thinking that Jim Bolger might stretch Poetic Flair even further and run him over 2 miles, but then I realised you meant those two milers. Talking of staying horses, what about the rematch between Subjectivist and Stradivarius?
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, they didn't get a clear and fair run in the Ascot Gold Cup. Everybody has their own opinion on it. I think the best horse won on the day. He was best placed on the day because he was comfortable and relaxed in the position he was in. Stradivarius found himself where he was because he didn't travel with great fluency early. And I think Frankie, just, it can happen to anyone, and it was one of those things that was unfortunate. But I don't think on the day Stradivarius was the best horse. Subjectivist has for a while threatened to be the preeminence there. I had to tip my hat to Tony Mullins, as I think everybody did, with Princess Zoe. Had it been 24 hours later, she might have even won the race, considering the heavens opened to such a degree. But it wasn't to be. It was something a little bit like watching Miss United run so well. A mare essentially National Hunt bred and bought for that game, and ending up second in the Ascot Gold Cup. It actually was a little bit of the theme of the week. You know, good, honest-to-God prices, horses that were inexpensively bought, competing at the most illustrious meeting in the world, and doing so to great credit. And I thought that, it, particularly in the two-year-old bracket, we saw with Eve Johnson Houghton's Windsor Castle winner, we saw it with Berkshire Shadow. Honest to God, you have a chance. And that's what last week's Royal Ascot meeting showed, that you can go to the sales, you can buy a horse, not for millions, not even for hundreds of thousands. You have a chance of a winner at Royal Ascot.
And finally, Jen, I want to get your thoughts on Love, because we spoke about her so much last year, even though she actually only ran three times last year. Is this the beginning of a glorious campaign, or is she one shot and you're out, do you think?
I have massive respect for Audaria, so I was impressed, having looked beaten 2 furlongs down, that she was so honest and genuine and grounded out. It wasn't flashy, it wasn't impressive, But considering I have a lot of respect for the runner-up, I think it's a first step in the right direction. She wasn't dominant, but I think if you go to a mile and a half, she can be. We saw last year in the three-year-old bracket, she was outstanding. Again, what she beat was questionable, but it was the fashion in which she did it. And I think, yes, she is the leading light of Ballydoyle this summer, and the world is her oyster.
All right, so it's Tuesday, and as is customary every week on this day, we go around the bloodstock world with our friends at Weatherby's, their stallion book, and their Global Stallion app. And I'm very pleased today to check in with Brett Jones from Airdrie Stud in Kentucky. And Brett, before we start and talk a little bit about the stallions, am I right in thinking that it is on the land now occupied by your family's Airdrie Stud that in fact the thoroughbred breeding industry in Kentucky was really founded?
That's exactly right, Nick, and that's a great legacy for us, and something we're very proud of is that in the 19th century, Woodburn Stud really was the preeminent stallion farm horse farm in Kentucky, and Stallion Career of Lexington, who was the leading sire in the United States for 16 consecutive years. There were several, I believe, five Kentucky Derby winners and even more Preakness and Belmont winners raised on this land. So it's an awful lot of pressure to live up to, but a wonderful history and something we're very proud of, that the land could have that sort of success in its past.
So tell me a little bit about how it came into your family.
So my father, Brereton Jones, really started Airdrie Stud. Now, of course, the land had been used for horses long before he showed up from West Virginia, but he was from a tiny little town called Point Pleasant in West Virginia that I don't know had a thoroughbred in it. But for some reason, he just got it in his head that he was going to come to Kentucky because someone's told him that's where the fast horses were. And he was just so totally motivated to come into this community, start a farm, really do everything he could to try to make it, and 50 years later, I'm sitting here and get to reap the benefits of some pretty incredible work that he did with my mother. Now, that's the patch of land that they started on had been in my mother's family. They very much worked it together. I think Dad would be the first one to tell you he wouldn't be here without Libby Jones, but it all started as far as Airdrie Stud aspect and part of this land that started in the early 70s, and he built it up really from the beginning.
And it's not as though your father wasn't quite a busy guy. He was an incredibly respected politician and has been the governor of the Commonwealth of Kentucky. How on earth did he combine the two things so successfully?
He moonlighted as governor. His great passion was always thoroughbreds. He felt he kind of an obligation for public service. I think is really where his political life came from. He saw an opportunity. He thought he could be helpful, and so he ran for two offices. He ran for lieutenant governor, and then he ran for governor. And when he was done with that term as governor, he said, "I want to go back to the farm." So the farm life really bookended his career. It was never about politics. His great love was always horses, and anyone who knows him, it doesn't take him long to realize that about him. He's been horse obsessed from the beginning, and really got to live out his dream.
And so, when you were growing up, was that was the side of his life that rubbed off on you? You were always more likely to be thoroughbred breeder than state politician.
Yes, no question. I love the business. I started working on the farm when I was very, very young, and would watch every tape of stallion prospects that I possibly could, and would follow all of our horses. And like so many people, my love for the track was really brought about because I went to the races with my dad, and seeing the joy that it brought him. And that was something, again, from a very early age, I was just totally drawn to, and something much like my father decided at an early age, that's what I really wanted to do with my life.
215 stakes winners, 24 grade one winners, you know, over $115 million just in the last couple of decades. What do you think is the selling point of Airdrie? How do you try and market your stud to differentiate it from other concerns?
Well, I think it's really, the marketing has been what it's always been, and that's that we really believe in a philosophy of trying to raise horses what we call the right way, and what a lot of people call the right way. I know that's a bit of a cliche, and you hear a lot of people saying it, but for us, it really is just about keeping things simple and keeping horses in big fields, keeping horses outside, raising horses to compete. And we're blessed that we have the land and the people that work with us, an amazing team that share the same philosophy. So I think if we have a reputation within the industry, I hope it's of raising horses the right way, being honest with people. And then from a stallion standpoint, we keep a large broodmare band here. We have about 150, 160 mares at different times and at all times. And we breed the overwhelming majority of those mares to our own stallions. So that's another part of our reputation, I think, as a farm that we really get behind the stallions that we stand, give them that opportunity, not just the first year they stand at stud when they need very little help, but in those coming second, third, fourth years, really doing everything we can with our broodmare band to try to help give them that support.
Brett, do you have a type when it comes to a stallion? When you're scouting, is there something you're specifically looking for?
Well, with us, you know how competitive this business is, and it's never been more competitive than it is right now. And as I said, Dad started the farm in the early 70s and did so without, you know, the luxury of having another business that gave him that money. The money that we make and that Dad has made over the years has all been through the thoroughbred industry. There's no, this isn't a passion or a hobby. Certainly it is a passion, but it's also our livelihood. And so, we have financial constraints that so many of our competitors won't have. I mean, we have to find horses that we believe can be a really good investment. It's not just who can find the shiniest stallion. But when we zero in on one, it really is because we believe they have every chance to make it as a stallion. And as you say, a type, I would say the one thing you don't want to sacrifice is that inherent ability that, people call it brilliance. It's something you feel like you know when you see it. They've got that it factor. And then, of course, you want pedigree and you want a beautiful horse that the commercial breeders will get behind. But for us, it's all about, finding that horse that isn't going to be the $30 or $40 million stallion necessarily, but can start at a reasonable stud fee and have every chance to go up the ladder the way that we've been lucky enough to have some stallions in the past too.
And who would have been the stallion that had the most sharp trajectory, say starting from humble origins and then getting somewhere quite special for you? Which would be your poster boy in the time that you've been involved with the stud?
Well, since I've been around, Indian Charlie and Harlan's Holiday certainly fit that description. They were both stallions that started. Charlie was a $10,000 stallion. I believe Harlan's Holiday started at 17.5, and both have gone on to be very important, really genuinely important stallions. When you look at what Indian Charlie was able to do and now Uncle Mo, what Harlan's Holiday was able to do now Into Mischief, his son. So that's a great point of pride as well. But I will tell you that if you ask Dad who his favorite stallion of all time would be, I would say almost definitely be Silverhawk, because of how much he meant to this farm. Right. In a time in the early 90s where the market had really turned. Silverhawk was a horse that we'd brought over, had raced in Europe and England, came into very little fanfare. I believe he was standing for $3,500 early in his career. And when the market was troubling, then that's really when Silverhawk started producing fast horses. And we rode that wave. He was just sort of a dream stallion and got to the point where he was a highly successful, an international stallion, an important stallion. And he was a major, really a very important horse for this farm at that time, and really allowed us to go on and continue to try to chase the dream and bring in the next one.
And he even gave us back an unexpected Derby winner in Benny the Dip in 97.
I remember it well. We were listening to the call, my father and I, and on the phone, and it's one of those early great memories you wouldn't trade for anything. We were so excited and knew just, what a big deal that was for our stallion.
And when I look at your roster now, I see a lot of young, exciting horses, and any one of those really, or all bar a couple, could end up fitting that bill, could end up becoming a horse that everybody talks about. American Freedom's first two-year-olds this year doing well. Cairo Prince collected a really very good racehorse and beat some fantastic ones. Complexity, Creative Cause, Divisidero, still a young horse. Include McCracken, Preservationist, Summerfront, and Upstart. You know, there's a lot of youth in that roster.
Yes, that's exactly right. And this is sort of the next, hopefully the next chapter. We did lose Harlan's Holiday and Indian Charlie over these last few years. You need that horse to step up and take the mantle and you know, be that real breakout stallion. But I think we've surrounded ourselves with enough possibilities. I know you've had my friend Nico Deschambeau on here, Nicola, and we're all chasing our Wooten Bassett right now, and hopefully one of these can jump up and do what we really think they have the capability of doing.
Of course, the difference with Wooten Bassett is that so few people wanted to use him in the first place, and you're from 20, 25, 30 mares, he managed to turn base metal into gold. I you wouldn't be able to withstand a really, really short book with a stallion, would you?
Well, it's hard, but sure, there's plenty of precedent. You know, Into Mischief, who referenced earlier, who's taken this market by storm, started from very humble beginnings, was not a popular stallion, as I think anybody at Spendthrift would tell you. But that, again, that's why we keep the larger broodmare band, because there are times where the market, frankly, disagrees with you, and they may not be willing to breed to your stallion, but if you really believe in them, then you are. And so those lean years, you can do your best to avoid by breeding 20, 25, 30 of your own mares to a stallion if you really believe in them and give them that opportunity, you know, which is a slippery slope. It's a tough game to play, but if you really believe in what you're doing, you're willing to do it and see how the chips fall.
Where are your heart and head at the moment as regards this roster?
My heart and head, well, you know, all of them, we wouldn't bring them in if we didn't believe in them. But the stallions you named, I mean, Complexity is a horse that I think has a ton of potential. He was extremely popular his first year at stud this year. Very talented, had that early two-year-old form, and then went on and was a top older horse last year, running as fast of numbers as just about anybody who got on the track. So, you know, it's a roster with potential, and we just need to try to put ourselves in position to get lucky.
And in terms of the future of Airdrie Stud, Brett, and this is a question I've asked a lot of people in your position, how much responsibility do you feel to the place, to the land, to the legacy, to the next generation?
A tremendous responsibility. I mean, it's a family farm. We take great pride in that. I know the work that has gone in, not just from Dad, but from the guys that are still working on the farm with us. I mean, we've got Mark Cunningham, our farm manager, has been here 40 years. Bruce Manley, our maintenance manager, has been here 40 years. And myself and Ben Henley, who Ben is our general manager, we're about the same age. And we both feel a real obligation to those guys that worked, you know, so hard to kind of put Airdrie to where it is. We really need to do everything we can to continue to make this place a success, and we're both committed to it, and we're going to work real hard to try to do it.
Brett, thanks so much for talking to me.
Nick, I enjoyed it, man. Thank you so much for having me.
Right, time to round things off with Jane then. Jane, quick word about the Irish Derby this weekend. Is this where we see the real high definition step forward and just smash them all up?
Well, he's going to have to be very good because it's a good, strong renewal of the race. You have Mojo Star coming from Ipsum and Hurricane Lane. So you have the second and third from Ipsum, and you have McSwinney likely to be there too, amongst many others. So high definition, the vibes are strong. Obviously, he missed Ipsum because of different reasons, but yeah, he's had plenty of time to recover now. I don't think there'll be any excuses. But he's not, for me, the horse with the best form in the race. There's the Epsom form is always leading into the Curra, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing how it stands up, because that is what we want. We want the Epsom Derby to be a strong race, and it's going to be tested for the first time properly at the Curra.
So you think Mojo Star's the one to be with?
I really like Hurricane Lane. Don't ask me why I think they're going to turn the form around, but I think he's. This is a very good race. This will be very interesting, and I hope the ground is quick so that we have an honest and fair race.
Okay, so Hurricane Lane for you in the Irish Derby. You're spending the next couple of days at the Derby Sale, which is one of the premier national hunt sales in Ireland for unraced horses. Are you buying, selling, observing, spying? What are you doing?
I'm pretending. Uh-huh. I think that's the best way to describe it, as many of us do. But look, the Derby Sale, I was at the Land Rover a couple of weeks ago. It was extremely strong and very fruitful and positive to see. Look, the Derby Sale, you've had Shishkin and Honeysuckle, Appreciatus, Black Tears all come out of this sale. This is where good horses emerge from. The key is to try and find them.
Well, we're all pretending, Jane, you know that.
We're all frauds, but as long as you know it, that's the key.
And please, can you unfraudulently give me a winner for this afternoon?
Well, I am going to try at Newton Abbott, the 7:15. I like the top weight, Small Bad Bob. He had very good maiden hurdle form here for Paul Nolan without actually winning. And Luke Scott taking £7 off his back in the amateur hurdle for Paul Henderson. I think Small Bad Bob will hopefully carry top weight to victory in Newton Abbott.
Jane, thanks so much for your time. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks to all my guests today as well. That was Tuesday, June the 22nd. We'll see you again tomorrow. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with Fitzdares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.